And play with it a little bit too. Like, don't be afraid. You know, there's research out, and more, they're doing more and more research on this, but they've seen athletes now consuming up to 100 grams per hour of carbohydrate in those ultra endurance events, which is pretty wild. But you know, we think about this isn't just for pushing that event and performing your best, but it's also for the recovery.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. My guest this week is Dana Eshelman. Dana is a nutrition coach for endurance athletes, and she is also a returning guest. I talked to her about a year ago. Last time we talked, she had several half Ironman races under her belt, and she was looking at doing a full Ironman. She completed that goal this year, ran her first full Ironman, so I invited her back to talk about her race, as well as to share more great advice on fueling and hydration. The last time we spoke, I learned some new things about fueling, and this time I learned even more. So I hope you can learn something, pick something up from our conversation aware as well. Here's my conversation with Dana Eshelman.
I'm in Arizona right now, but I'm actually moving back to Colorado
Okay.
in like a week and a half. So, yeah. So,
Okay, yeah, because last time we talked, I think you were in Colorado.
yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. So you moved to Arizona for, was
Yeah.
that for work, or just decided you needed a different location?
Yeah, just or actually all of my family's on the West Coast, California and
Oh,
Arizona,
okay, yeah.
and they're like all raising families. I have little like nieces now, so it was just like a temporary thing. I was kind of seeing it how I liked Arizona, didn't love it, so
Different than
that's
Colorado,
when.
yeah.
Yeah. And you just, I think especially in Colorado, you don't realize how spoiled you are with having like the mountains right there and the roads right outside for me to just like hop on my bike or go run or and which is very much a lifestyle. So it was just a big change for me because now I'm having to drive, 20, 30 minutes to be in a spot that is safe to go ride or something like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, there's and the, yeah, the traffic in Arizona is it's amazing. We were there 2006, and this geographically it's about the same size as Kansas City, but I think there's twice the number of people there. And so
Yes.
I would so I would get on the road thinking the traffic should be, and traffic in Kansas City, people complain about it. There's nothing like, I mean, it's the way the road systems are in Kansas City, the traffic is really pretty mild. And I get on the roads and I was like, where did all these people come from?
Yeah. It gets very trafficky, especially downtown. So, yeah.
Yeah, but
Definitely.
it is beautiful. I mean, did you
Yeah.
there's where the I don't can't remember what the name of the park where the Javelina 100 is. Have you looked at those trails at all?
Oh my gosh.
McDowell Park?
Yes, McDowell Ranch, McDowell something, but yes, I have actually rode around it and then like through it and all around. So,
And those are
yes.
some good roads to ride. I mean, the
Yeah.
Fountaindale and going out toward Tonto Verde and
Yes. Yeah. That's actually where I usually would end up on my ride just 'cause still some population there, but it's definitely not like downtown Phoenix. So,
Right. Yeah. Some population, yeah. You've got desert and as well, but there's places that there are people, at least
Right.
people driving down the road. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not like you're out in
Which
the
I
middle of
mean,
nowhere.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
So.
and the mountains, those mountains are different than the ones in Colorado.
Yeah.
Just being around that area, you've got some elevation, but it's just not like Colorado.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. So where'd you go for your swims?
there it's oh my gosh, what is it? It's Bartlett Lake. So actually that just north of Fountain Hills,
Okay.
Scottsdale.
Okay.
So yeah, so pretty it ended up being like an hour and 15 minutes away. I didn't go swim there every day, but like for open water, that's where I would go. And then, I mean, just for recreation, like doing a lap swim. I had a couple different locations that I went to. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. So,
Yeah.
yeah, and just one of the things that you had mentioned that the last time you'd done some half marathon or half Ironmans, and that you were training for a full Ironman, I saw you completed the full Ironman. I was like, oh yeah, I should have you back to tell about your experience with that.
Yeah, I
So
love it. So
yeah,
that's awesome.
cool. So you moved to Arizona. Was that like all of your training done after you moved to Arizona for the?
Yeah. So I did my half Ironman here in Arizona in October, and I actually the week before my half Ironman, I was like, I'm just going to move down there at the same time. And I was like, and then I'll just train all like winter, because at least I can be outside some of it. Whereas like, obviously Colorado, I would be all inside. So it was nice to be able to be outside. Because I did my, I did my Ironman in St. George, which it's very warm there and windy. And Arizona is very similar in terms of climate. We get some winds, I would say, but not quite like St. George, but we definitely get wind, to where I was able to kind of train for that mentally.
Where's St. George?
Utah.
Utah. Okay.
Yes. So just like, honestly, like you are just on the border of like Utah, Colorado, Nevada. Like it's like we actually, I drove from Phoenix into Vegas and then into St. George. So it's very close to the border. Mm-hmm.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was your training regimen like? I mean, you obviously you said you were having to drive more, but you were able to train outside. I mean, you said not having to do treadmill or a stationary bike, I'd imagine.
I did some of my sessions on a stationary bike, more because of hitting certain. So my coach, what I like to say is we focus on quality over quantity, which is really powerful, especially as a female athlete, and just focusing on the quality of your workout. So power output, making sure that I'm hitting certain zones at certain times, basically to simulate a longer session. And so that was really helpful. But so those specific sessions where I had very specific watts to put out on my bike, I didn't train with a power meter on my bike. One, because of cost, and two, because they're very expensive, and triathlon in itself is pretty expensive. So I have a smart trainer, so I was like, I'm just gonna use that. And then also time, right? You know, there's only so many hours in a day, so I have to be cognizant of where my training fit and what was gonna serve me mentally and physically. So a lot of those sessions specifically were done on my trainer. But if I had, sometimes I would have scheduled a session that just says an endurance ride, and so no true zones to hit. It's really putting that that effort to the test, essentially outside. Like, how does that translate from what I've trained with on the trainer to being outside? Mm-hmm. So that was really helpful. And just, so those days I definitely made a point, you know, to practice bike handling skills, things like that. But I was fortunate. All my runs were outside. I didn't do any treadmill runs, thankfully. I think we all can agree. I mean, I think the treadmill serves a purpose, again, kind of similar to a trainer, but I don't love it. So
I'm curious, because I used to own a treadmill and I got rid of it. And, it was one of those things that back then it was a place to store clothes, you know, the clothes that, you know, to dry. We didn't really get the kind of, I mean, it's a typical, that was before I was a runner. But since I started running, I tried to run on a treadmill at the shoe store when I was, they were testing it, and they took one look at me and says, just go outside because I look like a buffalo on ice. So not having the experience of running on a treadmill, I had somebody talk to me who does treadmill running. And I mean, normally I run outside no matter what the weather. If it's a time for a run, you know, I'll just go out and run. But he talked about how he'd been running on a treadmill a lot during the winter, and then went outside and he found out it was a lot harder. And so how much does that equate, you know, the treadmill, because you're, you know, and I told him, I said, well, the treadmill, the road's already moving.
So you're essentially not pushing the pavement, to speak.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I wouldn't, don't quote me on this, but like what I've read and what I've been coached on is whenever you're doing a treadmill session, you should always put it at an incline. So 1 or 2% to account for naturally when you're running outside, you're going to be on a grade at some point. Mm-hmm. So you want to account for that, but it also takes the weight of that belt essentially out of the picture.
Okay.
So then you're kind of like pushing the pavement. And then the pace. So say I'm aiming to hit like an 8 minute per mile pace. I would go like 0.2 miles per hour roughly over that normal pace. Because again, the belt is moving for mm-hmm. you. So it's kind of training your legs to move a little bit faster.
Okay.
So that's what I've been coached on and how I actually haven't asked my current coach. I should ask her, but I haven't asked my current coach as how that translates, but yeah, that's what I've okay. read and heard.
Yeah. So. I didn't want to put, I mean, since it came up, I was like, well, maybe you would know because the guy he'd mentioned that to me and I thought, well, you know, I don't know anything about treadmills because I don't run on them.
Yeah, I think they're a great tool to kind of, for example, if you're looking to improve your pace, and you're not, like, your legs have to understand what it feels like to move that pace for a certain distance. So doing something like repeats on the treadmill can be really effective in understanding what that feels like. But you do want to take into consideration the grade that you're training at, mm-hmm. Because you know, running outside or in any situation, you're going to be on some grade
right.
at some point. Yeah. So, yeah.
Very few places are flat except Florida and some places in Texas, I think.
Right, right.
Just like a pool table, you know?
Yeah.
I know a runner in Florida and she talks about having to, when she travels, and you know, the hills are so much different besides being at sea
I'm
level.
Sure.
I'm a chi running instructor now. And so, you know, thinking about, you were talking about using the treadmill. Mm-hmm. One of the things in chi running is increasing your cadence. And I could see that could be a helpful mm-hmm. tool for mm-hmm. if you were wanting to move your cadence up and learn how to shorten your stride mm-hmm. without having the, you know, without having the ups and downs of hills. That could be a tool that might help, especially for people who might struggle getting that faster cadence.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah,
definitely. Mm-hmm.
Well, great. So what were kind of the mental challenges? I mean, you've moved. I mean, you know, like that's one of the top stressors in life is moving to a new location. And you just decided kind of like, oh, let's go do this. And then put yourself into the stress of, oh, you know, doubling your distance of going from half Ironman to a full Ironman. You know, what went through your mind as you were training and getting yourself ready for that?
Gosh, I mean, I have always, I mean, for so many years, I've wanted to do a full Ironman. And it kind of dates back actually to one of my last years in my undergrad in college. I had a professor that was an Ironman athlete and I was like, wow, that is so awesome. Like I want to do this. And at the time I was just running. So I didn't have any idea like how to put swim, bike, and run together. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what that meant. I had swam, I had biked and run on separate occasions. And so as I started even training for a 70.3, I was like, this is so cool. I'm one step closer kind of thing. I'm almost there. Training for a 70.3 and training for an Ironman are two different ball games. Mm-hmm. You don't real like right. It's literally double the distance, and right. So, I have heard from other people that I currently train with who have done full Ironmans that it's a lot. Like it's going to be a part-time job at the very least, and that is just the training. You don't take into consideration. The recovery from that training and the nutrition from that training mm-hmm. and all the other things. And I always joked, I mean, through that time period, really from I had a break after my 70.3 in October. So I kind of ramped up training again in November through May. But my, like, my second job was basically eating. And then it's wild. And understanding, like, as a dietitian, myself, you know, I had to bounce off ideas off my coach all the time. Cause I was like, I know how to coach people on this, but I was like, I'm always eating. I'm always hungry. And I was like, what do I need to do? And she's like, just keep eating. So that was a big, not a big barrier, but just like realization, I think, like, oh my gosh, this really is a full-time job. And then the training aspects in terms of like those mental barriers that just overcame along the way. I mean, one was I got injured. So that's always more a setback, but also a mental barrier, I think. And just like, kind of like, oh shoot, what, like, if this injury kind of persists through my training, how am I going to come out on top? And it did persist. I honestly, up to 2 weeks before the race, so basically right before my taper, I actually wasn't able to run over 2 hours.
Wow.
So that was very concerning, being, you know, you have a full marathon at the end. And I mean, I cannot finish a marathon in that time. So that was a concern, but kind of, you know, seeking out the help that I needed from like both chiropractic and physical therapy. And then just being cognizant of my recovery time. I would say most triathletes, even runners too, like, we tend to overtrain.
really?
So, some of my workouts, like, I would just go like an extra mile on my runs, or go like an extra 20 minutes on my bike. And so my coach would be like, stop, you can't do this. And so basically trusting the process of that progressive training load and understanding what that means for my body. And not only for like my body, but also for like my mental and physical health too. So beyond just like those training adaptations that you see, making sure that you're not pushing and redlining all your workouts, because there's a reason why we don't do that. So that was another kind of, I think, a big realization, especially in this distance, was just like, their workouts are programmed in a way to allow for this progressive load, and for your body to adapt to that progressive load over time. We can't be 100% all the time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So I think those were my biggest takeaways, was just the understanding that this is a process, and trusting that process, and then the training demands and the time commitment that it takes overall.
Yeah, you said recovery was an important part of your training. What were the challenges you faced with making your recovery part of, you know, making your recovery work for you, I guess?
Yeah, and I think this is for truly anybody that's not getting paid to do the sport, right? So
yeah.
all of the recreational or age group athletes, you know, we have a job outside of this training. And so it's more difficult than you think to have find that rest and recovery. Definitely. So I committed to my bedtime no matter what. I've gotten a lot better about this over the years, especially, but like hard and fast bedtime was like, I was in bed by 8:30. Whether I was actually asleep, I mean, sometimes I was reading, but my phones were off, screens were put away by 8, and I was in bed by 8:30. So that was like a non-negotiable for me. And then a big part of my like rest and recovery was integrating stretching and yoga to some degree, and then towards the end also incorporating more sauna for recovery too.
Okay.
So mm-hmm.
Yeah, yoga. Yeah. I've heard people who do that, especially, well, especially stretching. And so do you, I'll get to that. Save this question for the end. We'll get back okay. to stretch. Just get back to stretching. But so you're a registered dietitian, and you mm-hmm. coach. You're a coach for endurance athletes,
right?
And yep. And you typically most of your clients women. Are you kind of focus on women? Or do you do both men? Women?
I have both men and women. I have a big focus on like hormone health and finding the balance, especially for female athletes. So I tend to draw in more women, but I definitely serve okay. the male population as well. So
yeah. It's one of those things. It's hard to coach yourself. you mentioned that.
Absolutely.
That you knew what you could do for other people. So what was mm-hmm. that? What was that transition like? What did you feel yourself with in your training?
Yeah. I pretty much preach to all my athletes too, but we tend to be a carb phobic society in general. And it's, you know, it's very important. Carbs are very, very important in those peak performance training blocks, especially. And so as I ramped up my training, I found more and more that my body actually was like I needed those carbs. So that was a big portion of it, but also protein and finding that balance. So carbs always surrounded my workout. So pre and post. And then I really tried to find balance with my protein and then lots and lots of color. So we find fruits and veggies are increasingly important to help with that anti-inflammatory process. So that was really, really important there. And just making sure I still had that balance and getting in good nutrition. But kind of to like walk through a day, essentially, my training sessions generally started around 4 a.m. And so I was at least up by like 3:15, 3:30, making sure that I had a little bit of something, before I got out the door or hopped on my trainer or got in the pool, whatever. And so that was always generally like a piece of toast and peanut butter, or I also made like little energy bites, which are just like oats and peanut butter and honey. And I always added protein powder to that. And then I always, I'm an athlete that really struggles with my appetite after workouts. Not super hungry, so I make this shake that's about a 2 gram of carb to 1 gram of protein ratio, and then depending on my workout, if I needed a little bit more carbs after my workout, if it was like a high intensity session or like a 4 to 5 hour training session where my body's like, hey, you need more carbs, mm-hmm. I would add in a little bit more, like something like oats to it, or just an extra serving of fruit, for example, or something like that. And my smoothie was loaded, as I like to say. So I always add at least 2 cups of veggies to it, anywhere from 1 to 2 cups of fruit, and then coconut water, protein powder. What else is in there? And then, like I said, I'll blend all that up and then I'll add oats to the top of it. So that's generally what that looks like. And then from there, it was really eating every like 3 or 2, I would say closer to 2 to 3 hours. and so that was kind of what it looked like. And then if I had a training session at night, too, which was pretty normal to do, especially in those higher training blocks, sometimes I would have 2 smoothies a day. Sometimes I would do like a yogurt parfait for dinner. So Greek yogurt, berries, walnuts or almonds, and a scoop of peanut butter was generally what that looked like. So again, pretty simple to go down. And then the protein from Greek yogurt specifically that casein protein, really, really great before bed, especially for athletes. Hmm. So, yeah.
That's cool. So yeah. did you count calories and watch your weight?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I'm an athlete that actually has like a pretty long history of eating disorder and disordered eating. So I don't count my calories. I'm pretty cognizant of like calories and amounts that I'm eating, but I'm really, over the years, I've become pretty in tune with my body and just understanding what's termed intuitive eating and what my body is craving at the time and what it needs. There was points, especially towards the end and what I would say my last month, that I felt depleted a little bit. And even though I pretty much kept similar nutrition patterns through my whole training, but as my training increased, I recognized like, hey, you've got to either add a little bit more to your food or to your meals, or you've got to add in another meal. And, so that was something that towards the end I had to kind of play with a little bit. And again, that communication with my coach was helpful too.
Yeah. Well, like you said, eating became a part-time job for you.
Yeah. between like food preparation and eating, I mean, I was eating 6 to 8 times a day, roughly. So it was a lot for sure.
So I know there are a lot of runners that I hear from. They, their fueling program is much different. And they say, I run so that I can eat. Mm, so, mm-hmm. What's your kind of take on that? I mean, they're eating kind of, well, almost anything. It's just kind of like the standard American diet. And just mm-hmm. kind of putting those things in. What difference is there in those? I guess is there a better quality fuel than?
Yeah, definitely. And when we think about, and this may get a little sciencey, but I'm always happy to. I'm going to try to put it in layman's terms for specifically. But for example, if we go out running, that's called like our exercise activity, which is actually only 5 to 10% of the total calories we burn in a day. So it's such a small portion, right?
Well, our watch says, your training your training watch says you've burned all these calories, and I think I'd go out and eat 1,500 calories right now.
right. So that's something to consider because our training watches, any, people that log in MyFitnessPal that say they burned like X amount of calories a day and they can eat all these things, those are just calculations and they're not perfect. And so,
which I know, because if you eat, if you think you can eat whatever you want, because your watch tells you you've burned all these calories, you'll end up
gaining some weight,
getting mm-hmm. the next pant size, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So we always want to tap back into, again, that intuitive eating side. And, even if you burn X amount of calories, 800, 1200, if you burn that many calories in a session, that doesn't mean you need to eat those calories back, right? Mm-hmm. And especially if your goal is weight management or body composition or anything in that sense. Because that could be energy that you're expending, so to speak. But we all have a basal metabolic rate that our body is used to. And so you, in a sense, eating those calories back can set you off of your weight goal if that's what you're searching for. So the terms, when you say, we have folks that are like, they're running so they can eat whatever they want. I would say that maybe is an imperfect way to look at it. We want to look at running more on the ends of like the benefits that it's providing our body, how it makes us feel, how it, all of those benefits, mental health, emotional health, all, and physical health too. More on the side than it's going to burn all of these calories, because again, that's only 5 to 10% of the total calories that you burn in a day. So mm-hmm. it's a, such a small portion.
Yeah. And that, and I find that, you know, like you, you said, once you exercise, I don't have to eat too much at the end of an exercise session to feel mm-hmm. satisfied.
Right. You know, exactly. Yeah. So tapping into that intuitive, sense and seeing like, am I actually hungry, or what is my body actually hungry for? And that really can help set you up for success.
Here's a message you need to know. It's not too late. A lot of people get to age 40 or 50 years old. They look at life and think, I'm running out of time. You know, those plans and dreams you had of doing something epic, doing something big, doing something significant. Travel the world, start your business, write your novel, make your documentary, become an Iron Man. All of those dreams sometimes seem to be fading into the mist as you get older. But here's the thing, it's not your age that holds you back. It's called limiting belief. And all of this, everybody of us, every one of us have limiting beliefs. And a huge majority of people are very happy and content to live all their lives inside the boundaries of these limiting beliefs. But if you're listening to this show, I'm going to guess that you're not like the majority of people out there. I would think that you want to have more from life than just being average. So if you do find yourself held back by limiting beliefs, if you find yourself saying, you know, I know what I should be doing, but I just can't seem to make myself do it, I can help. Go to the ultramindsetpodcast.run, schedule a free 25-minute mindset reset with me. I'll help you get started on getting you on your way to overcoming your biggest obstacle that's holding you back. That is ultramindsetpodcast.run. If you're on a computer, it will be off to the right. If you're on a phone, scroll clear to the bottom. Find a calendar there. You can get on my schedule for a free 25-minute mindset reset. It is not too late.
So how did things progress? You did the training. How did things progress through your Ironman?
Through the actual race?
Yeah, through the actual race. What was your strategy for that? And as far as, you know, you have to manage. I mean, you've doubled your distance that you were used to. It was kind of unknown. So what was your kind of thoughts going in to manage your energy output as well as your fueling?
Yeah. So going into the race, we knew, like I said earlier, we knew it was going to be hot. We knew it was going to be windy. So in the heat, you naturally are losing more sodium. You're sweating more, right? And you're actually expending a little bit more carbohydrate. And that ratio of carbohydrate you burn is a little bit higher when it's hot out. So I knew that going into it. And so I calculated my carb goal a little bit higher, about 20 grams per hour higher than what I had trained with. And so I will tell you, I probably planned my nutrition for about a month, like solidifying my plan, making sure obviously that I trained with it in my sessions, especially in that last month. All of that. And mm-hmm. so I had it pretty fine tuned. My race day plan went out the window around like mile 50 on my bike.
I'm glad I'm not the only one that happens to.
Yeah. It was very hot. It was hotter than I had planned on. And my stomach, I didn't have any GI issues, thank heavens. But my stomach, like I felt this, like it felt like a brick in my stomach when I was eating solid food on the bike. Specifically, I eat peanut butter and honey sandwiches mm-hmm. on the bike mm-hmm. generally, with some salt, base salt. Yeah. Yep. Perfect. So yummy. And it's like a treat, right? You look forward to it. Every time I would, like pull, you know, I eat about a third every hour. So that's a third of the sandwich for me. I'm with the honey I put on and everything. It's about 40 grams of carbs per hour that I'm grabbing. And then I have liquid nutrition on top of that. So I was doing that. I got through one of my peanut butter and honey sandwiches at the end of like mile 45-ish. And I was like, I think I'm done with these. And going into my race, so I'll back up a little bit, but the morning of my race, I had a long waiting window. We got dropped off to take a shuttle and then got to our bikes, and basically we're waiting there for about 3 hours before I even could get in the water. So it was quite a long time. And so within what I would say from the time I woke up to the time I started the race was about 4 hours.
Okay.
So in that 4 hour period, I had about 150 grams of carbs before my race. Mm-hmm. So a lot. And so basically what I had there was a cup of oatmeal, so a full cup, a banana, a bagel with a little bit of peanut butter, and then about 16, well, I had 32 ounces of water, but one of the 16 ounces had precision hydration in it for the salt specifically. Mm-hmm. And then one had UCAN performance in it. So that's kind of what I did pre starting everything. But I felt like was really sufficient going into the race. And then, like I said, at mile 50, I switched to all liquid nutrition, from mile 50 of the bike through the marathon.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was really effective. So it was I think it ended up getting to like 96 or something that day. So pretty warm out mm-hmm. there, and there was no covers out, like there was no trees. Mm-hmm. It's pretty similar to Arizona in that like high desert type climate.
Mm-hmm.
They on course, they have Gatorade Endurance. So that's what I used on course for the rest of my ride and the run.
Wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So just Gatorade, didn't do the goo gel pack things or?
On my run, I had 3 UCAN Edge gels.
Okay.
So they're like the gel version of in UCAN.
Okay.
And those work really well for me. So UCAN's a more sustained energy release, whereas Gatorade's a quick release sugar. So I felt that the UCAN really helped give me that stable energy, whereas like when I kind of felt like an energy dip, I was like, ooh, I need some quick sugar here.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And the last time I had you on the podcast, you talked a little bit about the difference in with the sugar. If you just take the same kind of sugar, like if you were just doing Gatorade, that you actually need to have a balance of two different kinds of sugars. Was that kind of what you planned for you?
Yeah, a little bit. So Gatorade actually has the two main sugars in Gatorade are glucose and fructose.
Okay.
In the form of maltodextrin. And then they also have fructose in there. I don't know off the top of my head specifically, but they do have a couple different sugars in there.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is you have different carbohydrate or glucose shuttles in your small intestine and in your stomach and actually even in your mouth that help digest those sugars. So put those sugars into your cells to be utilized.
Mm-hmm.
The more variety of those glucose shuttles that you can use, the better your body's going to be able to absorb those sugars and put them to work. And then also, you're not going to experience that rotten gut and GI distress. So it doesn't cause that like dumping effect of the sugar into your small intestine.
Huh. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you, is there some place that tells kind of what somebody who or is that somebody something that people could get that information to be able to make a plan for themselves?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even if you, so specifically in the products on the market today are using a lot of maltodextrin, which is a ratio of glucose and fructose.
Okay.
I think it's, I can't remember the exact ratio off the top of my head. I think it's like 0.8 grams to point or to 1 gram fructose to glucose. So that ratio in most
so it's people's the fructose to glucose ratio is what you're what you need to look at. Okay.
Yeah. And that, so that can be helpful. And then, one other, you know, and everyone's different, because maltodextrin can upset people's stomachs too. So it's, it kind of goes into this, this trial and error, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And this is why we try, we kind of have practice runs in our training sessions and all of that, because we want to make sure that it's working for you.
Mm-hmm.
So something, for example, and why I used UCAN is it doesn't use maltodextrin. It actually uses cornstarch. So cornstarch is digested differently than that.
Okay. So cornstarch, I mean, that's what my wife puts in to make gravy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it's like a thickening agent.
Yep. And you can tell, you can like the product specifically is a little bit thicker.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of follows that thickness, mm-hmm. Which some people, again, it kind of, you know, all the nutrition products you use, it comes down to like what you like in terms of taste preference, but also what your body tolerates. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, and oftentimes I think your body, it depends on the day of what your body can tolerate. Cause a lot of people that I've talked to running ultra marathons, it's like a couple of them have just tried, you know, gone in with a new product and that often doesn't work out well. That's something they haven't tried in training. But, but oftentimes the plan, like you said, goes out the window.
Yes. Yep. And so that's, and this is where I actually always recommend you should have a plan A and a plan B, and making sure the course that you're training for, or, for example, if it's Ironman specifically, they are partnered with Gatorade, so they're always going to have Gatorade Endurance. So training with that is not always a bad thing, because you know what's going to be on the course.
Mm-hmm.
Also kind of just researching whatever race you're doing, what products they're going to have available, because training with those things is a good idea, because you can have your plan A with things, you know, maybe outside of that, but if you need to fall back on the on-course nutrition, I mean, it's there. It's available for you.
Well, and,
right?
You know, a lot of times I know people have their own thing and they put in their drop bags, and they go, plan on the drop bags being there. And as long as the drop bags get to where they're supposed to be, you're fine. But you know, if something happens and your drop bag gets lost, or, that there are a lot of things can happen in a long race. And that's a good idea to have that backup and be able to know that you can tolerate what's available at the aid station.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, in this event, like I obviously had my drop bag kind of ready to go. I grabbed a few things out of there, but I didn't end up grabbing like any of my solid food, because I was just like, I just know my stomach is not happy right now.
Mm-hmm. So were you planning on solid food for the entire Ironman?
I was planning on it at least through my bike, because again, I mean, it's such a long day that I was like, I'm gonna be hungry, and I actually didn't ever get hungry. I didn't feel hunger. Mm-hmm. So my body was obviously happy with what it was getting, which is great. I'm very thankful for that. So yeah, but I had planned, in my grab bag specifically, I had a Yucan bar. So I had that, and then I had another peanut butter and honey sandwich that I was planning the second half of my bike.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So is that common with the athletes you coach, of them not being hungry in later stages of an Ironman or an ultra marathon?
Mm-hmm. Especially when it's hot. So that's not uncommon at all to experience that. And that is when you have to kind of check in with yourself on a deeper level and be like, am I not hungry because I'm hot? And then again, if I eat, am I going to get sick, kind of thing? Because there's that balance. And if you find that you're like, I'm not hungry because it's hot, then you need to up your liquids, and not water specifically. You need to up your sodium intake, and then your calories that you're consuming in your whatever electrolyte drink you're choosing, because that becomes increasingly important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was pacing somebody in an ultra marathon, and you know, toward the end, we were getting toward the end of my shift, and ended up pacing a friend of hers as well, and it was like, they told me ahead of time what kind of intervals they wanted to eat at, and mm-hmm. it was like, we had a 15-minute argument about whether they should eat or not, and it's like they were both saying, you know, I don't want to eat anything, and I said, and they were. They still had a long ways to go. So I kept saying, no, yeah. Let's eat something.
Yeah. Yep. It's always, even if you don't feel like it, I mean, and it's so hard because especially when you're out there for such a long time, we have to think about endurance sports specifically are catabolic, meaning they're breaking down muscle tissue as well. Mm-hmm. So that also can cause kind of an anorexic effect there. So it immediately decreases the appetite because now your body is in this breakdown stage. So that this again is what I kind of meant, why we have to check in on a deeper level of like, what's going on? Like, mm-hmm. why are you feeling this way?
That's interesting. So how do you get to, I guess, to that deeper level? Because most, I think most of us tend to live on just like whatever surface is there. And mm-hmm. Is that as a mindset thing you can practice to get better at?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it again comes from that intuitive eating space as well. And understanding your body's needs. And even as an endurance athlete, like you, and this kind of goes into that practice as well. Like, you know what you've trained with and what makes you feel your best. And so we want to be cognizant of that. Even if you change your plan from plan A to B, understanding what ratios you're getting in terms of carbohydrate and understanding, you know, you do need exogenous carbohydrates. So you need to ingest carbohydrate in order to perform in any activity longer than 2 hours, and really hour and a half for most people. Because when you don't, that's when we see people hitting the wall or just completely zonking out of energy, right? Mm-hmm. So that deeper level check kind of comes from a couple places of understanding your limits as an athlete, and then also understanding what exactly you're taking in. So, you know, each hour, what does that look like for you? And play with it a little bit too. Like, don't be afraid. You know, there's research out, and they're doing more and more research on this, but they've seen athletes now consuming up to 100 grams per hour of carbohydrate in those ultra endurance events, uh-huh. which is pretty wild. But you know, we think about this isn't just for pushing that event and performing your best, but it's also for the recovery.
Okay.
And what that looks like.
Mix in protein as well.
Yeah. So, protein isn't going to impact performance, but it's going to impact recovery. So, the immediate,
in the race, then protein is not necessarily a
performance enhancer.
Performance enhancer. Is it mm-hmm. something that helps with endurance?
No, there hasn't been research.
There's a lot of, in ultra marathons that I've run, there's a lot of protein. The bacon, there's hamburger. I mean, there's been a lot of times. The cheese quesadillas is one that is pretty popular.
Mm-hmm. So protein is something that can help reduce muscle fatigue and that delayed muscle soreness. So depending how long the ultras are, if you're going for 12 plus hours, you can actually start to feel that delayed muscle soreness in that time frame, mm-hmm. right? Even though you're still moving and it's still considered like the same race for you, your body is already having this deeper breakdown. So this is where something like, you know, bacon, things like that. Bacon actually is considered more of a fat than a protein, mm-hmm. but those proteins and what they provide specifically are essential amino acids. And so if you wanted to supplement with something like an essential amino acid powder, if you're somebody that doesn't tolerate solid food super well when they're training or racing, that can be something to add in. And again, this is going to help with the way your body recovers and how you go into your next session or your next race, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I had another question on that as, but I was, I was going to make this a two part question. I was like, okay, what was the other thing I was going to ask you, with proteins and, calories versus you've talked about, grams of carbohydrates. And most of the people who talk to me about the ultra events say 100 calories per hour. So mm-hmm. What is the difference of calories per hour versus grams of protein grams of carbs?
Yeah. So roughly, and everyone will be different on what they need, but with these ultra endurance events, we're specifically going to be looking at carbs. For every 4 calories, so one gram of carb is equivalent to 4 calories. So
okay,
does that make sense?
So the 100 calories per hour would put you in quite a deficit.
Yes. Yeah, okay. That would be very low, and that because even when I'm speaking with most of my female endurance athletes that are doing any of these ultra events, we're shooting closer to 250, 300, 400 calories per hour.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Because so when we look at anything over really 3 hours, we're aiming closer to 60 to 90 grams of carbohydrate per hour.
Okay.
And that's what's been seen as effective for supplying the body and those muscles with fuel that it needs to do work.
So in training, do you do the same kind of thing? I mean, because you're training kind of with, you said you train like you run.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So each season I build my gut tolerance up to that amount. I don't just jump right in and say, oh, I'm going to do 60 grams of carbs today, because that is quite high. And so for somebody maybe that's just starting to introduce carbohydrates, start small, start slow. I usually recommend starting around like 30 grams of carbs per hour, and you gradually build your tolerance up. Again, most of the sports nutrition products out there are pretty gut friendly. They've done their research. There's a lot of really great supplements out there now that are actually made by athletes. So those higher ratios are better tolerated. So that can be a really great place to start for people.
Yeah. And then I know there are some other, you know, some people who are athletes who are in the development stage of coming up with new supplements and products as well. So
yeah. Yeah. It's a big market for sure.
That's true. Well, and it would be finding, you know, kind of finding what works for you as well. But
absolutely.
Yeah. You've given us some good kind of baseline for helping people figure that out.
Yeah.
Oh, tell me again, how did your race go? I mean, I kind of left off the middle of the race.
That's okay.
At 50 miles in, how did the rest of your race go? You were on liquids the rest, but you completed it.
Yeah. So, truly I felt strong the whole race. I was kind of warned about getting into these dark moments of like what can happen in these ultra events, right? And I didn't ever feel that. And I was just so happy to be racing and be out there. And the energy at this event too was very real. So there was times that I was kind of by myself, essentially. Like there wasn't many athletes around me or spectators. And so that I kind of was like, I wonder, like, I'm just going to kind of enjoy my space out here. Like, this is great. So that I didn't experience that, but like I said, the end of my bike went really well. There was some pretty tough climbing in there. So there was points during the climbs that I was like, holy smokes, like, this is tough. And, you know, I passed people that actually were walking up the climb. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting for me to see. And then getting off my bike, the run is my favorite portion. So I was super excited. I was ready to be off my bike, if I'm honest. You know, that last like 10 miles on my bike, I was just like really excited to go run. So, which sounds crazy. I'm sure people are like, this girl is wild, but it was just, you know, something different. And I was like, you know, you like, awesome job. Like you finished the bike portion. So the run was great. A kind of boring run for sure. It wasn't, the course was essentially deemed as two loops, but it was out and back and then out and back again on the same route.
Okay. So it wasn't really a looped course then.
It was an out and back.
Out and back twice. And yeah. Out and back once is
yeah.
It's kind of a mental strain is enough, but you did it twice.
Yeah. And so the run I truly just focused on one direction at a time, so to speak. So one out, and then I kind of was like, check the box. I'm going back. And then, you know, check the box. Now I'm going back again. And that's kind of really helped me mentally in that space. But, you know, I'd mentioned earlier that I struggled with an IT band injury, from January through actually late December through May. So I was concerned that I wasn't going to be able to complete the run portion. And mentally I was like, if I have to walk, I have to walk, like it's okay. But my goal was to just keep moving. And I ran the whole way, ran a little bit slower than I had planned on, which, you know, is okay. But I finished, my time was 13:05. So I felt very good for my first, it was my first full Ironman. So felt really good for that time. And just, like I said, I mean, just so fun to be out there and doing it.
Yeah. Well, thank you a lot, Dana. Tell people how they can find you, if they want to connect with you.
Yeah. So I'm on Instagram at @DanaRDN. I'm also on Facebook. My Facebook page is just @DanaPerformanceNutrition. And those are the best ways to find me.
Okay. So. Well, great.
Yeah.
Before you go, I have a tradition I started called the bridge questions.
Okay.
Who approaches the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side he see.
Ask me the questions, bridge keeper. I'm not afraid.
You mentioned stretching. Mm-hmm. So you stretch before a run or after a run?
Depending on what kind of stretching it is. So static stretching, which is like basically standing still and kind of lengthening those muscles, you always want to do on a warm muscle. You don't want to do before your runs or before your workouts. I do more dynamic movements before my workouts. So activation, which some people can call term as stretching, but activation or a dynamic warm up.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, cool. Yep. Second question. The weirdest thing that you've seen when you've been out running, either on the trail or on the road?
Oh my gosh. I cannot think off the top of my head. I mean, I'm so many weird things. I still think, and this is kind of in the triathlon world, but I still, think that like peeing on your bike is just so weird. I just think it's really funny, but to me, I guess that's kind of
that is thing. I've heard about that, like the Tour de France riders do that, but I did not know that was a thing among triathletes.
It's technically, quote unquote, a skill you have to master. So it's very different.
That is very weird. Okay.
Yes. Yep.
Third question, a word or phrase that sums up your kind of philosophy for life.
Ooh. I think the quote of like, run the race you're in, and kind of bringing it back to being present in the moment.
Great.
So, yeah.
Well, thank you. Appreciate you being here.
Yes. Thanks so much for having me. It's always fun to chat with you and talk.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and you know somebody who might like it as well, please take just a minute, send them a link so they can listen. And if you enjoy most of the episodes, please tell your friends. That's the best compliment you can give. I truly enjoy being able to spend time here with you each week, and I appreciate that you take the time to listen. If you have any comments, questions, or stories that you'd like to share, go to ultramindsetpodcast.run and you can leave a written or a voice message. You can also find the show notes for this episode and more at the same link, ultramindsetpodcast.run. Remember, it takes an ultramarathon mindset to go the distance in running and in life, and a strong mindset is a skill you can learn. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.